You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Get ready for a little surf and turf action on Midnight Run Through, a podcast miniseries devoted to celebrating the 1988 contemporary classic action buddy comedy Midnight Run, written by George Gallo and directed by Martin Brest. Co-hosted by me, One Heat Minute Productions' Blake Howard.
And me, Jen Johans from Watch with Jen.
Each week, we'll explore the film we first bonded over when we became friends in 2019 by surfing through an incredible roster of guests from journalists to novelists and beyond who love it as much as we do. Digging into Serrano's finances and Alonzo Mosley's FBI files, come with us on Midnight Run Through as we crisscross the United States with the characters played by Robert De Niro, Charles Grodin, John Ashton, Yaphet Kotto, Dennis Farina, Philip Baker Hall, Joe Pantoliano, and company on screen. Today, our guests are...
Megan, go for it.
Yes, so I'm a crime novelist. I've written 11 novels, 11 crime novels. I also write for TP, and I also do some work for Criterion on camera and essays. I'm going to be talking about Todd Browning in the forthcoming Todd Browning back set, which should be great. I mostly talk about Freaks and rather obsessively in great detail about every shot in the movie. And I'm just a big movie fanatic, so really excited to get to talk about this. It's a movie that I probably watch 35 times when it was on HBO in the late 80s.
My name is William Boyle. People mostly call me Bill. I'm a writer, novelist. I've written, I don't even know how many books there are now, 6 or 7, I think. And hopefully have a new one on the way next year. And just wrote the Criterion liner note essay for One False Move. I have a story coming out in the Best American Mystery and Suspense 2023 that Steph Cha and Lisa Unger edited, and big movie fan, and you guys know that, and write a movie column for the Southwest Review every month, and it's great to be here. This is one of my favorite movies, and I love you guys, and excited to talk about this.
But before we go any further, let's kick things off with Jack Welch's Old Turf with the ultimate question.
Why were you so unpopular with the Chicago Police Department?
Yeah, I mean, I could start by saying because I remember the context that it came out in, it just was very unusual for De Niro. People who are younger may not realize for De Niro to do this kind of movie. Certainly anyone who's, you know, there's so much comedy in a lot of De Niro's performances, even in Mean Streets and something, King of Comedy of a different kind. But he was just, it seemed so unexpected for him to be in this movie. And at the time, I also loved Charles Grodin, mostly from these sort of, you know, Heaven Can Wait, these sort of, you know, sort of romantic comedies that he was often in at that time, and the way he would show up on Late Night on David Letterman and things like that. So, I mean, it just seemed like an impossible combination. And that completely worked. And also the thing that sort of is specific to 80s buddy movies is that, that they're very adult movies in many ways, in terms of their violence and their crime plot and their emotional resonance. And I feel like people stole all the wrong things from, or got all the wrong ideas from Midnight Run and have never been able to sort of put that mix together, but also eminently rewatchable. So yeah, you would be the thing, you would turn it on, it would be on at like, you know, 6 o'clock on a Tuesday, and you would pick it up in the, you know, in the bar scene or in the boxcar scene, or, and you would just watch, you know, all the way through to the end. So it was just a perennial for me.
I didn't have cable. I never really had cable. And so I never saw it that way. I was 10, I think, when it came out. And so I probably didn't see it. I definitely didn't see it in the theater. Probably didn't see it until, you know, the next year, whenever it came out on VHS, 89, I guess. And, you know, by that time I would have been, you know, already, I guess by 10, 11, 12, I was watching as many movies as I could. Mm-hmm. I was watching movies compulsively. And despite my last name, which is Scottish, my dad is Scottish, I grew up with my mom and my mom's side of the family were Italian. And I grew up, you know, heavily Italian American neighborhood with my Italian side of the family. And Robert De Niro was, you know, was God, you know, to in the neighborhood and the family. So I would see everything and anything with De Niro. So I'm sure that's what drew me in. And it's kind of, I mean, I think to me, it's kind of one of those movies that shaped my taste. Like all the things I think of as that I love the most, you know, this is one of those movies that kind of was the beginning point for me, like road movie, you know, kind of a little bit. I mean, it's not quite like a screwball movie, but it's got elements of almost like screwball noir kind of thing that I love. I don't know if it would fit neatly into that category, but I think it's, you know, close enough. You know, that kind of buddy action road comedy, just it's everything. And it's De Niro, you know, it's I'd never, certainly at this point, I'd only seen him as a kid. I'd seen him in, you know, whatever, King of Comedy and Taxi Drive, because I watched those movies way too young.
We all did.
All that, you know, the Untouchable. This is probably like right up coming after the Untouchable, you know. So I'd never seen De Niro in a part like this. And certainly I was, you know, I think, I don't know if it's still true, but at some point I think Midnight Run was kind of like the most swears in a movie, you know.
It was. I remember reading that.
And that was attractive to me as a kid, you know, who was just starting to watch like adult, you know, or R-rated films. I shouldn't say adult films. I wasn't watching adult films. But, you know, R-rated.
We got what you meant. Yeah.
That's a different podcast.
It was huge. It was huge for me. And I loved it. And I still love it. And like Megan said, and like you guys said, it's just so highly rewatchable and so quotable. And, you know, that's not, those things don't always mean that it's like all the way great movie. And I think this is also all, you know, all the way great movie. So,
yeah, I love that you guys watched them young, because I remember when it was a brand new release on VHS, which is when I saw it too. It was one of the movies, I don't know why I didn't grow up like sounding like a trucker, because the movies I watched the most as a girl were Midnight Run, Beverly Hills Cop, both were directed by Martin Brest, and Jumpin' Jack Flash, is kind of crazy. Those were the three movies on constant rotation in our household. And, you know, I grew up with a huge crush on Robert De Niro, and I think it was because of this film. And so I just love that you guys around the same time were watching these movies, because then it's like, okay, we would have been friends even back then. Yeah, I love that.
Totally.
It's funny that like discoverability now, you kind of passively have it, I guess, in streaming. Streaming's so like assault you with new stuff. And that's why, I don't know if you guys have this like on any of your streaming services, but usually like it, you know, especially some of the big ones are not like Criterion Channel or something, which has great like little curated things so you can go down nice rabbit holes. But it's like you scroll through and it just looks like all this garbage. And then like you see a movie that you're liking, you're like, I'm just going to watch this again. And like, you know, particularly with my wife, she's like, again? And I'm like, I just don't care. I don't,
I can't be bothered getting a Blu-ray out of the shelf. I want to watch something that is easy, and I just, you know, it becomes, and that was the great thing about cable back in the day of any kind, or even like, even in Australia, commercial TV, I think they kind of would like see what rated and they just play movies over and again, like every second Saturday night is like a new Adam Sandler movie. Like that was like 10 years in the 90s. But like, this is that early proto version of that. It was like cable movies. The Lethal Weapons were later, the late 80s ones, obviously Buddy Cop, stuff like Midnight Run, and they just play and play and play. And them being in the background, they kind of just start to get to you. And that's the kind of movie that gets to me, is the things that I put on in the background. Like I've told this story a few times to Jen, is like when we did One Heat Minute, I was watching Heat so much tactically for research purposes and preparation that I used to put all the President's Men on in the background when I was working. And then after a while, I started not being able to concentrate on what I was doing because all the President's Men was on. And then I was like, oh God, there's really something here in this movie, isn't there? And then I was gone. Then there was the next project wrote itself. But that's the kind of thing that Midnight Run has, which you try and put it on just because you're like, oh, this is fun. And you just then are completely transfixed. Like, oh, this movie just rules. Everything is pens down now. It's Midnight Run time.
I think that's so true. I talk about that a lot, about that sort of lost where you had no control over what was on, and so you would watch, and this is true of regular TV too. I grew up before cable, when it was watching the Saturday movies, and whatever was on was what you watch. And the fact, it's sort of like when people would go to the movie and they would come in the middle of a movie and then they would watch it till that point, you know, they would watch it through. I do think there's something amazing about that, because it makes you look at a movie a different way, from different angles, and it makes you think about scenes in a special way, and it becomes like a film school. Really, it really teaches you how to love movies, because you're not just watching it to see what happens. You're you have this sort of different appreciation for it, because you're kind of stumbling upon it, and everything looks a little different each time because of where you come in, where you enter the story.
Yeah, what grabs your attention?
Yes,
could be a frame or a line delivery. Yep. You know, I have tea, you know, just that, or just like an amazing shot, like just an amazing shot, picking a lock. And you're like, ooh, like that looks like he's really picking that lock, you know, or whatever. Yeah. It's a really fascinating way to approach it.
Yeah. I didn't really have that experience too much beyond like what was on network television. Because I didn't have cable, so I depended on the video store, and I would often, my rewatching happened because usually I would take my grandparents' VCR and my mom's VCR and dub movies.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
And so that was how I got to rewatch stuff, and I would only really do that with stuff that I love, and Midnight Run was certainly a movie that I did that with. And I think maybe by the time I was, you know, I can't remember when VHS got affordable, but as soon as it was like, you know, $20 to buy one or whatever, I think I started buying VHS tapes instead of doing that so much. But
oh, people had definitely... this is a point in time, like you go and buy 4-hour VHS tapes and you'd be saving things, and you're like, you're like, all right, I can get two and a half movies, or maybe. Or maybe
you're doing the math.
Yeah. You're like, okay, yeah, God.
I would have a VHS tape, and I didn't, like I said, I didn't have cable, but when I would go to visit my dad occasionally, I didn't see him that much, but I would go there on weekends sometimes, and he did have cable, and I would just bring a VHS tape, put it in, and record what was ever on. Like, I didn't even know, and then bring it home and watch it and hope I caught something. I'm good.
Kids are today just never going to know this life. They're just never going to know double taping life. Never going to know recording off the TV and pausing so that the ad breaks happen. You just never, you guys don't know. You're never going to know.
Keeping your fingers crossed that it doesn't run out.
It's going to work. Yeah. But also, I think, especially with something like this, you watch it for different reasons when you're young. And I know rewatching it later, there's things that stand out so much more that just flew by me as a kid. And I think certainly the visit to his ex-wife and the daughter, which now just kills me. It's just a devastating scene. And those actresses, Wendy Phillips, and I don't know the one who plays the daughter, who I don't
it's,
think
it's Dan any- it's her name's Danielle Duclos, and she hasn't done really much after this, but she was Spellbinding.
Yeah, so she just knocks you up. You know, she, this, her expression, the way it's so expertly done, and it tells you so much, and it changes, the movies change thereafter, and it buries the sort of weight of that, and it just never, I'm sure I paid no attention to it all when I was a teenager watching it, but it, that's what's so great about movies like this that you just sort of watch over and over again over the course of your life. I think too, I'd be curious to see what Bill thinks of this. I'm always surprised at how they're not types. As most buddy movies, you have a type, you have the quiet, mm-hmm. the quiet guy and the psychopath, or the straight arrow one and the, you know, and the lunatic, but they're both have like unexpected qualities in them that they bring out in each other, because Grodin is really much more of a loose cannon in his own way. And De Niro is in some ways this, you know, a very soft person too, and is the one that's sort of going through this sort of journey of himself. So that I always forget how many different facets of their personality emerge.
Yeah, I agree. I was just reading about that scene with his ex-wife and daughter. That was heavily scripted, that scene. And the original script was a lot more was written, and it was De Niro who was like, no, they should talk less. They should say less. Yeah. Was, you know. And that scene, I think that's a perfect example of how something changes for you from, you know, for me watching it at, you know, 12, obviously, is much different from watching it now at 44. And I totally agree about the fact that they are not, I mean, I think that's one of the things I love, is that they're not types, that they're not, you know, they don't stay within some lines or some box that some studio executive said, this needs to be this kind of person and this needs to be this kind of person. They're kind of both messy and unexpected in lots of ways. I love that. Yeah,
I had read, this may have already come up for you guys, but that the screenwriter George Gallo said that they were based on his parents. And that I guess his father was sort of a nervous man and his mother was just sort of reserved, and then we just sort of wait for him to have his little anxiety attack and then steamroll right through and make what happened, so that he, that dynamic he thought was so funny, the way they talk to each other, and I love that idea, because in many ways that it is a romance really between the
it
two
is.
It's always surprised. I always forget how emotional it gets at the end with the two. It is a love scene at the end. And De Niro really goes for it in some ways. It's like you can't even believe that they're going sort of this far. And I think it makes sense given the DNA that this was, you know, this sort of old bickering old married couple.
Grodin has said that this was the fullest character he had played at that point. He said, you know, everyone thinks it would be my guy in the Heartbreak Kid, and that was a great role, but it was a little more narrow. And he said this was like a full man with different sides and his most complex character. And I thought that was really interesting, that he was kind of looking back on his career and thinking this was the character that he got to play all these different facets. And I think for exactly those reasons. Yeah,
I remember reading, you know, talking about what Bill was saying about types and like studio, you know, studio, that they were, you know, Brest was able to keep them free of studio interference, because I feel like trick Grodin's character pulls out of his sleeve, the studio note would be, this guy wouldn't know how to pull this kind of, you know, this is an accountant. What does he know? But of course, people are very complex. And
he's a mob accountant.
Exactly.
He's a mob accountant. If anything, he's very shifty.
He's, you know, taking this enormous risk, you know, he's obviously has this sort of whole different energy, and but that would be the note, and the fact that they were able to make some full character to resist becoming types.
I love what you said, Megan, there about the research of them being an old married couple, because the line that I immediately thought of there was just like, you know, a restaurant's a bad investment. You know, like just that. I've literally heard like aunts and uncles like, oh, you know, that thing you want to do, that dream you have, well, it's a bit risky. You know, I've run the numbers, and the other their partner just looking at them like, why do you trample my fucking dreams all the time? You know, like that, yes. That's just like, it's so right. You know, like, why can't you just let me have a fantasy, you know, like let me enjoy. Yeah. Fantastic.
Or the smoking and the eating, like you keep doing stuff that's bad for you, even though you know. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. And my favorite line in the movie, which is when he comes back on the freight train and says, I'm not talking to you for the rest of the trip.
Jack, it's a bad Jack. Easy, Jack. You son of a bitch. Jack, you shut up. I'm not talking to you for the whole rest of this trip.
Which is the best.
Anyone who's been on a road trip with their family knows that.
Yeah. In that famously improvised line with Grodin with the "Have you ever had sex with an animal?" which is like
a couple of good looking chickens.
Yes, I mean the way to get De Niro to really respond genuinely. I mean, but Bill, what you were saying about it being a screwball comedy, as soon as you said that, I thought there's a little bit of Sullivan's Travels in this. You have the boxcar and you have the unusual couple thrown together that it has to become a team and the romantic energy between them.
Yeah, no, that's a perfect point of comparison.
Yeah, and married couples, it's like when someone says you've got a vice and they always like chip you about it, like the De Niro response of like, interesting, he just keeps smoking. okay, cool. Like just because it's like, we're not arguing about this anymore. This is what it is. So it's happening.
It also reminded me so much on this rewatch. I mean, you know, I know this movie came after and Midnight Run is certainly not an influence on it, I don't think, but the way that De Niro talks to Grodin in particular is like the way that Vincent Gallo talks to Christina Ricci in Buffalo 66 a lot of the time, which is just, you know, like, I'm going to stick your head in the toilet bowl and make it stay there or whatever he says, you know, just a similar, like, you know, I don't know. It comes back to what we're talking about. I think that kind of like romantic energy, like violent romantic energy or whatever.
Exactly. And like Christina Ricci's sort of deadpan and Charles Grodin's dryness, it's the perfect. Yeah. Opposite for that, you know, that I think it drives both the other characters crazy that, you know, you can't shake them with their extreme words. And I think it's you know you love all the great character actors in it. I'm dazzled by, I always forget how many are in it, but you always want to come back to the two of them. You just, you know, you're always eager to get back to the core.
We'll be back after this.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Quick break. It's also funny. This is the first time that I've thought about this, Jen, in one of our conversations, is that whole when you're with a partner for a time, like one of you has an irrational fear and like how De Niro threatens to kill Grodin with the dog. He's like, I'll shoot you through the shower, but get the fucking dog away from me. It's like that's such a married couple screwball comedy thing of like, I've got a gun, I'll shoot you, but this dog, you get it away. I'm scared of the dog. He's not scared of shotguns, He's not scared of shooting down helicopters, jumping off of boxcar trains. Like, he's not scared of tackling someone out of a flying away plane, but a dog that's barking, even when he's holding a gun, he's irrational fear. It's fantastic.
It's a great character note. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's unexpected.
Exactly, which is why I sort of love what comes right after when they're on the airplane and De Niro is so excited to be getting first class treatment. And like, he's like, in the napkin, he's flourished with a napkin. I think I'll have the steak. What do you have? And you just sort of see it sort of all sort of spit, you know, all going down. But he's so excited for this. And like, that's a, you know, that's, they just wouldn't do that now. The bad version of it is that he's all business and he needs to get him there. But the fact that he wants to enjoy this champagne, we'll have the best champagne, the best that you have. It's so fabulous.
You were talking about some of those other character actors. Who are your favorites? Yeah. Because I feel like in both of your work, you guys have these wonderful side characters that your different leads approach. And so that's what I love about this film, feeling more like in the deeply crime, you know, genre, which is that there are no small role, like the in crime movies, I think they get that, like, there's no small parts, there's like amazing room for you to stretch. And in this movie, when you look down the list and it's like Yaphet Kotto, John Ashton, Dennis Farina, Joey Pants, you know, Philip Baker Hall, it's so full and just overstuffed that you're like, oh my God, everyone is great. So who are your favorites?
I mean, all those guys you just named, I love it. Obviously, I think to me, it's, you know, Dennis Farina when he's on screen is just totally electric. And I love all those other guys, but he's just so good in it. And it would have probably been, I guess, you know, the first time I saw him in anything. I can't remember if Crime Story was right before this or what, or right at the same time.
It, probably a whisker after, or you might have done this and then Crime Story.
Manhunter, though, you probably
saw. Manhunter first. And his very first role was in
I don't think I saw Manhunter until after this, though. Yeah. But yeah, he's incredible in it. I just think he's perfect. Just every line delivery is perfect. And, you know, obviously I love the connection to PTA and Heart Eight, and the Sydney character is fascinating to me, and, you know, it's been something that's drawn me back to this movie, just thinking about it in connection with that movie. So those are two big ones for me. But yeah, Joey Pants is amazing. Yaphet Kotto is always incredible. He's one of the greats ever.
It's so funny. It's hard. Like, I feel like I could make the case for any of them, but I was especially tickled this time by John Ashton, because it's sort of like, you know, he so doesn't know what's going on, but he so has the force of like, he's just this force. He's just going to do whatever he wants. And when it works in your favor, it's great. When it works against you, but I think, wasn't he supposed to originally die?
Yeah. I was watching the Blu-ray extras, and the writer was talking about
that. I can see why, because he puts himself in like full force danger in these situations. And his, like, he is just so one directional that he cannot fathom that that there might be other stuff going on. And like, something about his blind stupidity about anything that's occurring around him, and his sheer belief in himself to get what it just makes me laugh every time he shows up. I just laugh. He's in a lot of good things. And I just remember him showing up in a lot of teen movies as the adult character and things.
Yes.
He really gets to shine, I think. And you just always love when the character actor gets to take on something like this. It does depend on this mix of more florid Baroque characters, these really people doing it really straight. And Dennis Farina is very funny, but it also works because he's very scary. You know, scared of him, and you need that. You need that menace. That's what makes this not just the language, but it feels like something bad could, you know, in the spirit of, you know, 48 Hours or other of these kind of movies from that era, violence does happen in that. So you have to make sure you're ready for it. And that's, I think, what makes it a grown-up movie.
I love what you were saying about John Ashton, because he pointed out the teen movies, and I was like, yeah, this was around the time of Some Kind of Wonderful.
Yes,
and it was also right after
the
Beverly Hills Cop. And so he was like kind of a straight man in that. And then he was the dad, and you know, you're going to college, Keith. And then we have this Marvin character where he's like just really into it. It's great. Yeah.
Yeah, that's one of the great screwball gags in the movie too, is just De Niro, you know, Marvin.
And then at the end with the airport, it's like, you know, Peter and Peter and the Wolf, you know, like, I'm not falling for that. Yeah.
I think it really speaks to Martin Brest, like the tone is really, he's the master of that, for all these character actors to be doing what they do, and for him to be able to like weave it all together and give it that right energy, because it could all fall apart, maybe in a funny way, but that everyone's in a different movie, but somehow I think that he really you know, I had read that he was a sort of taskmaster, a difficult, I think his DP quit in the middle of it or something.
Yes.
So I think he knew what he needed to do to sort of hold all these parts together, and you really see how much it pays off.
Yeah, yes. That's incredible. And I was almost laughing just thinking about when Grodin steals the plane and De Niro's like, you're a goddamn pilot, just keep saying you're a goddamn pilot. The way that's balanced with that scene Megan was talking about at the beginning where he's in first class and Grodin's putting on the act of being afraid to fly. It's so,
these things
so
go down.
So good. Obviously De Niro is incredible, but I love the slow build of Grodin's, you know, just he gets kind of, by the midpoint, he, you know, there's these moments of kind of wackiness, and you know, the look on his face when he shuts the freight train door on him, and then that whole sex with a chicken scene, you know, it's just also so good.
Yeah, it's so hard to pick. I mean, I'm sure everyone's picking the litmus configuration scene, but I have to say, I think it is really like the consummation scene if this is a romance, because the fact that De Niro is just rolls right with it. Story, and he's so good at it, looking at the bells, like this is when they've truly come together and they have found one another, and it seems like that moment in a screwball comedy, you know, because it's often like that in a screwball comedy too, when they fall down water, you know, like waterfall together, which we also, you know, like, you know, that's when it all comes together, but when they have sort of performed this perfect unit together. And And I think that there's just nothing that tops that, is that chemistry between them. I will say, I do have a soft spot for the, I'm going to get us some donuts. It's so random. And I just love, all those little details that, you know, I think that they totally sell it. And you know, I've never sort of changed killing off a character in the middle like that, but I am always impressed at how meticulously plotted this movie is, such that every time I have to think about what, you know, who knows what, when, where, you know, it is a real, real marvel with all those sort of elements coming together, and the track across the country and the timeline, knows who won, who's using the Mosley name now, and all of those elements. So I think that's it for me too. And the kind of noir aspect of the haunted pasts of so many, and the way that keeps coming back,
and they're all entangled, right? It's the, there's a great and it's nice to, you know, the Serrano shadow is over a few of them, and so like that's the great thing about a noir, is like the investigation, you find out that you're entangled in it, and then the investigation you're doing, you don't even, doesn't even matter anymore. Like it's more about you. It's a journey of self-discovery in some respects, which is awesome. But it's like, that's what's cool about this. It's like, it follows those beats, but in a very exciting way. And you talked about the donuts. I just love when Charles Grodin in that litmus configuration scene asks the guy if he dyes his hair. Like, I will fall off a couch. I can't even handle it. It's just the way he looks at him, you dye your hair. Bang, it's all over. 10 minutes, pause the movie. I just need a break. I need to have an air. It's the most ridiculous line. in a movie that has got fantastic, ridiculous lines. I'm just like, do you
die? He's pausing alone. No one can work a pause like Broden. A pause. Like,
when he like pounds the counter and then he and Nero look at each other, you know, like, yep, they gave 20s here. I love what you were saying, Megan, about like when things were doled out plot wise, because it is kind of like a noir. I always forget that it takes to that scene in the train, like with the chickens, but it turns serious.
Yes.
For us to finally figure out the deal with the watch, right, and the whites.
Yes.
Because they'd kind of been teasing out certain details, and then finally you get, and it's really late into the movie.
Yeah.
And it suddenly makes it kind of heartbreaking. And yeah.
Absolutely.
It keeps so much of that backstory under the surface in such an effective way, I think. I mean, there's I can imagine a much lesser version of this movie where they felt the need to show flashbacks or kind of, you know, fill in that stuff. And
we could not get away with this movie without digitally de-aged everyone.
Yeah.
We could not get away with it.
Yeah, we would have Chicago scenes.
I was going to say Chicago, terrible. 1978. Yeah. Oh, those were the good times.
Yeah.
Good times.
Also, Megan was talking about the timeline, and I just was really struck this time by how the movie deals with time. I mean, I know it's set over a pretty compressed time frame anyway, but even just the way it jumps between, there's kind of no factor. It doesn't bridge the gap between like those sections or sequences in awkward ways. I think it's just kind of, you're there and you buy it. And geographically, I mean, I guess geographically it makes some kind of wild sense, but it is also very wild. Like, it's wild that they're in Chicago and then Amarillo and then, you know, and so I like thinking about that this time, kind of the trajectory of the trip.
Yeah, there is almost an element where it feels like they're going back in time, because there's their the travel technology changes, and there's something classically like westward frontier about it too. And I think that, you know, and then of course, you know, you have to end in the terminus as Los Angeles, which is another classic noir. Also an ending in an airport with money is like classic noir ending. Like, you could name 15 noirs that end in an airport with who's going to get that money.
I read today also that I didn't check this, but they're in scenes where they're going east, they're always facing east, and in scenes where they're going west, they're always facing west. Which is something he was, Martin Brest was obsessive about.
That's so funny. Cool.
Yeah.
No wonder his DP quit. He's like, Marty, the light is awful.
The light is not good.
Yeah. It's not good, Marty.
I know they had to shoot part of the, I guess it's the water scene in New Zealand, I read.
Yes.
Yeah. Doing a reshoot, you know. So yeah, meticulous to detail. And I wonder how much of it was of, because the season had changed and
it was too cold.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that gives it this almost Wizard of Oz like quality that I think you're talking about, Bill, where this sort of, it's sort of like they, everything else is in time, but they sort of exist out of time.
Yeah.
Sort of, they leave the grid.
Yeah. I mean, and I don't, you know, you start to lose track of the days, I mean, which is part of the fun of it, I think. I mean, you know, there's not like, again, a much lesser version of this movie kind of has a ticking clock or something. And I love the shagginess of this, that you're just kind of aware in the beginning that he has until Friday at midnight or whatever, but you don't really ever think about that, you know, at any point during the trip, except when they're talking about like, I have 13 hours to get you back or, you know.
But it makes great choices, just like really classic functional choices of like, they're in a car, it's late at night and they drive hundreds of miles overnight, and we don't need to see that.
Right.
Yeah. No.
And it just makes the choice to cut. And then the next chaotic in the morning, and then they get on the bus and the bus goes for X amount of hours. And other than the preliminary conversations, like, we don't need to see the rest of the bus trip. And then it's on the boxcar. They're on the boxcar. They're established. Da, da, da. We know they're on overnight. So they have their overnight bit and then they're off. And it's just like, this is smart. When we need to pause, when we need to have some dynamism, when they need to have an interaction and there needs to be, you know, this moving exposition or like getting to know character, I think that that's the mastery, is like every bit of exposition also is like laced with character stuff. Like even just the approaches of how to do exposition to move the story forward is all done. Like, you know, you ever have sex with a chicken, like it has to be couched in all this weird, wonderful character detail. And so then you never feels like you're having to sort of eat something healthy when you want your cake. Like, cause it's just kind of all there, you know?
The math on the tipping on the train, yes. You know, and then we get, yes, exactly.
All that.
Making me laugh thinking of them carrying those grocery bags.
And then he drops them.
Which is like great exposition too. And it's like,
the glee of him walking out. And then,
And he got, I mean, there were like cans in that bag, which
I don't know what the plan was.
And it's, I kept thinking about that's when he leaves his wife's car and Amarillo, right? Yeah. His ex-wife's car in Amarillo. Yeah.
Don't worry. He went and bought her a new car.
Yeah.
And got her a new car straight away after that.
This has been Midnight Run Through with Blake Howard and Jen Johans. We'll be back next week with another episode. But until then,
see you in the next life. See you in the next life.